All right, so tonight is my last talk on this transcendental dependent arising. Next week will be a recap offered by Lindell, or a shorter talk, may not be a recap of this talk. And this, I'd like to begin this talk with a short poem that speaks to really this transcendental dependent arising and how it relates to dependent arising. It's by Samuel Green, untitled. Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Walking the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I stop at a single seed of hawksbeard balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. This short poem captures an essence of this whole year's teaching of how we add to this moment and how we don't allow the moment to be just as it is. Dependent origination describes how we create this burden, how we add, carry this ask life experience other people to carry this burden of what we know. And the transcendental dependent arising describes how we release that burden, how we let something be itself again. So the last talk I gave, we looked at how suffering can lead to faith, and then from faith to concentration, and then finally to this middle link of seeing things how they actually are. So tonight, I'd like to continue focusing on the next link and kind of devoting the talk to exploring what's called disenchantment. We could certainly keep going. I know I could with this topic, but it's time for it to round out. Next year, we'll have a different topic. So this link, disenchantment, such an interesting word. So this is another key link that's also tied to this poem. How this freeing this moment from ourselves is really the other links that naturally follow from that. Dispassion and liberation, all these qualities flow from this essential dispassion, which depends upon us seeing things how they actually are. If we don't see things how they actually are, there won't be that dispassion. And this link parallel has this interesting parallel to dependent origination. It's really centered around this point of contact. What I mean by that is this very moment, what's happening right here, right now, whether you're hearing a sound, feeling a sensation, having a thought or emotion. This is the moment of contact. That's that all that really exists in this moment is what's right here. And how is that moment? Does it arise? How does it arise? And how is our relationship to it? Are we relating to it from ignorance or from wisdom? What is that core relationship? So looking at these two parallel processes of dependent origination and transcendental. In dependent origination, there's this middle links from contact to vedana to craving. Okay? From contact to vedana to tanha. So again, contact, some sense data comes in through the mind, through the body, through the smells, through the eyes, the ears. And yet that contact, that raw sense data, is not neutral. It's profoundly shaped by our history, by our past experiences, by our biases, by our conditioning, by our habits, by how we've related and acted to similar things in the past. And this is how we shape and really create this experience of the world, our own personal experience of how this world is. And we were biased because of this, we're biased toward craving, toward clinging. So an example, simple example of this is our dog has a cute little blue heeler mix, but that's beside the point. But I've noticed that when I'm cooking in the kitchen and I drop something and he hears something hit the floor, he comes over eagerly, expecting some unexpected treat. Or even if I do something like I make a little mistake, a spoon falls out of the bowl, and I kind of grumble about that. He hears that tone of my voice, and he says, oh, maybe he dropped something. So this sense data that he's hearing, it's conditioned him to expect something. There's this trait, this craving, this thing that happens that then is linked in his mind. Okay, so this is the same process that happens to us. And certainly it has its benefit and has its use, but it also creates the prison that ties us to suffering. So contact to Vedana to clinging. This is the way that we perpetuate and maintain that quality of suffering. Another way of saying it is how we create the sense of self. Transcendental dependent arising is the seeing, this middle link section is seeing things how they actually are. Right? So instead of through our projection of the moment, how we want the moment to be, or how our past history shapes our very perception, our name and form, our actual consciousness, we actually see things how they actually are in this moment. And we're seeing that moment directly without adding anything to it. And this flows into disenchantment, which we'll focus on tonight, and then dispassion. So even the mental label, the history that floods forth, that's seen through is something that we've added to this moment. So we don't confuse what we add to the moment to what the moment actually is. That confusion is our ignorance, that we confuse our what we add and project on the moment as being the moment itself. The interpretation. Again, it has its use, it has its utility, but it also ties us deeply into our suffering and the suffering of others. So this not moving with, not moving away from, simply abiding with this moment's experience. In this way, we're not driven to craving. Disenchantment and dispassion naturally flow from this. This is why dispassion is this important tipping point, this point that if that arises, then we move easily down the slope. I mean, not easily, but we move toward liberation. Well, if that moment is not dispassionate, we're caught in craving, then we move towards suffering. That's the momentum that's set up. So now let's explore this word dispassion. And again, it's a very interesting word. And initially, it may not seem like this word is very much fun. You know, you're disillusioned. Doing a quick search on definitions. Disenchantment is the feeling of being disappointed with something and no longer believing that it is good or worthwhile. Or another definition, no longer happy, pleased, or satisfied. And the synonyms are dissatisfied, disillusionment, disappointment, or even a rude awakening. So this is the way we often hold this word disillusionment or disenchantment. And I like to explore how disenchantment from this perspective, from the Dharmic's perspective, is actually a good deal. It's actually very helpful for us. But we have to kind of unpack this word. Because sometimes if we just hear disenchantment, we think, oh, I shouldn't have any longings, any wants, any loves. I need to somehow harden my heart and disconnect from the world. And this is not what's meant. See, the disenchantment happens of its own accord. So first, we can look at it from kind of the more traditional way of that word's held, is that disenchantment is that disappointment, that things just did not follow through with our hopes, our dreams. You know, just finally seeing the futility. And this disenchantment happens all the time. It's a continuous process in life. If you haven't noticed it, you're just not paying attention. That, you know, there's this hope that if I finally get this experience, if I get this thing happens, I'll finally be happy. I'll finally be satisfied. And we chase after things constantly that promises fulfillment. And then we see that it doesn't lead up to that promise. Maybe momentarily it does, or for a period of time, but eventually even the shiny new thing we have dulls, tarnishes, and fades. So a fundamental question is, when that disenchantment happens from life's teaching us, does it lead toward more suffering or in ignorance, or does it lead toward wisdom? And this is the question we held a couple of weeks ago. With suffering, disenchantment, does it lead toward wisdom, or does it lead toward more suffering, more ignorance? Remember when I was a teenager, I was on the swim team, and I had a lot of investment in swimming well and improving my times and really poured my heart into it. And the final meet of my swimming career, I was very disappointed by the results. Like, I did not swim as fast as I thought I would. And there was that normal disillusionment, disenchantment. Okay, what I thought I could do, I did not follow through on. But instead of leading toward wisdom, it led to more suffering, because it reinforced, oh, I'm not good enough. I just didn't go through with it. You know, there's that process of reinforcing the suffering. And so this is our normal way of holding this disenchantment. I'm going to think of it as in a different way of exploring it. It's actually interesting talking about disenchantment this time of year, a few days before Christmas, which is sometimes a very enchanting time of year with all the lights and all the spectacle, the nutcracker, all those different stories, you know, experiences, the promise of the presents under the tree. But if you look back to that original story of Christ being born, and instead of, it really is this break from this normal or this historical way of a ruler, a king, was really connected with God. You know, sometimes in some religions, one and the same. And there's all this affluence, all this power. And instead, Christ is born in the most meager circumstances, in the meagerness of a manger. And how this story, however you might take it in terms of truth or mythology, or it's still an important teaching story of that disillusionment with the shiny, the rich, the power, to seeing something much more simple. Now, looking at disenchantment from a different perspective now. So enchantment, instead of thinking of it as something that's so, enchantment is something so beautiful, so lovely that we're just enthralled by it. But actually the enchantment, like we're under a spell, like someone has placed a spell over us, that we're under someone else's power. And there's not a sense of being free of that. Fairy tales, mythology, this is filled with these examples of the sorcerer's spell being placed on our hero or our heroine and having to somehow overcome that. This is such a common motif. The hero becomes enchanted, and then through that enchantment, they misperceive the nature of the world. They misperceive how the world actually is. An example that comes to mind is from the Lord of the Rings with Theoden, from the Rohan king, and how he was just really covered up by the power of this, the Dark Lord, and how his mind was just so contracted. He was really under this spell, and somehow he was able to break free of that. So the story typically goes that shows the pain and the sorrow of that enchantment, and then the struggle to break that spell. So this is mythology, fairy tales, I think, carry truth that's often helpful to reflect upon. Now, however, we are both the sorcerer and the hero. We are the ones who've cast the spell upon ourselves. We're the ones who've bewitched ourselves, caused this movement of away from how life actually is. And how do we break free? This is being lost in thought, lost in our projection of the world and ourselves. This is the process that dependent origination describes in such an elegant way, in such a precise way, and how this spell is created, how it's maintained, how we don't see life how it actually is. We see what life is through our projections, our conditioning, the namarupa, perception, consciousness. Vedana itself isn't neutral. It's shaped profoundly by our history, by our acts and actions, by our sankharas, all fueled and driven by our ignorance. And our practice, simply said, is to wake up from this enchantment, to break this spell, to be like that, the heroine in that story, to finally break free and see how things actually are, to feel that burden lift and not be under someone else's power. And we can wake up in small ways, momentarily, or profound ways that forever changes. This is mirrored in the Buddha's own awakening story, on the night of his awakening, where he has this intention to sit until he sees through his delusion, till he understands the end of suffering. And how Mara, the god of delusion, personified by that deity, throws his armies at the Buddha, tries to seduce him with these images of beautiful women and, you know, scared demons that are terrifying in these armies. And Buddha sits in the midst of that and sees through that illusion, the attempt to enchant, the attempt to put under his spell. There's one beautiful image where the arrows of the armies are flying toward the Buddha, and the Buddha, they simply turn into flowers and rain down harmlessly. Even after the Buddha's awakening, periodically Mara would try to trick him, try to enchant him, to try to put him under the spell. You know, I think Mara is a way of personifying this element of our own ignorance, of our own delusion, of our own minds that falls back into blindness, falls back into enchantment. And the Buddha, even years after being awakened, he would still have these moments of doubt, of unclarity arise. And eventually he would see through that and see, I see you, Mara. I see through you. And Mara would slink away. Again, the mythology of this beautiful tradition. So transcendental dependent arising. It seems like such a lofty thing to talk about, to try to obtain. That somehow I need to obtain and have these deep, sublime levels of concentration, these jhana states. And then from that place, pierce through this momentum of my delusion, of my ignorance, to see things how they are really are. You know, it seems a little daunting, a big ask of us to be able to do that, to see through all of this. But it's important to bring it into the immediacy of our own practice, to actually bring it down to earth, to see how is this, all this teaching actually relate to me right now as a human being in my own life, as a parent, as a husband, as a wife, as a spouse, as a retired person, as a working person, whatever place you are in life, how does this teachings come forth? Because that informs how we actually, or why we are practicing. I think sometimes if we don't step back and understand why do we practice, we're just kind of going through the motions. We practice, we focus on our breath, we focus on our body sensations. We know we shouldn't be lost in thoughts. We come back to it because that's what we've been told to do. And we notice if we do that well, we feel more calm, we feel more ease, we feel more centered. So we think we're doing well. This is getting distracted by the side effects of meditation. So we can follow the same steps, the same instructions, but not understand their purpose. It's not as beneficial. It doesn't lead us toward our awakening. And so it's very helpful to step back and see how does our very basic practice, the practice we learn from the very first day, actually orient us toward liberation, orients us toward freedom of heart. It helps us frame our practice in the context of awakening. Because if we, from this perspective, we're actually practicing all the time to clear this disenchantment. This is the main thing that we're practicing, learning to meet this moment directly, immediately, to see through our projections, what we add to the moment. This is why when we actually do this and you come up out of a meditation period and maybe look out into the nature around you or look into a friend's eyes, things seem more vibrant, things more alive. It's like it's in technicolor. Or after a retreat, you may notice this. There's a beautiful phrase from the Buddhist tradition that the dust has been cleared from our eyes, lifted from our eyes. And what's happening is we're not seeing through our projections. Our projections have faded, thinned, or diminished. We're seeing life actually how it is. And in that seeing, there's a vibrancy that comes back toward us to meet us. So this is a process of disenchantment, of actually seeing life how it is. The other day, I've been liking to sit outside on a bench among our trees in our backyard. And I was sitting, and my mind was just caught in a thought circle. There's something I was kind of mulling over and trying to release it, trying to come back to the body and the breath. But it had that gripping quality, that quality that just kind of self-maintained. It was interesting, in the midst of that, as I observed that quality, my whole world kind of focused in, closed in around whatever that subject was. I don't even remember what it was. But my world is, in a sense, the very world around me narrowed down to that. That's all that existed. Everything else was disregarded and ignored. Everything else faded. I was caught in a spell, caught in the enchantment. Perhaps this sounds familiar to some of us. And then I opened my eyes to let nature in. And immediately, it's like waking up from that enchantment, the vibrancy of the tree right in front of me, the beauty of the bare branch with a little bit of dewdrops on the thin branches. And there's such a contrast between this world of thought, this world of mind created, to seeing the reality of what's right in front of me. And of course, the felt sense was one of intimacy, of aliveness, versus being caught in this delusion. This is this disillusionment, to notice that when you come back from being lost in thought, whether it's connecting with your breath fully or a sensation or a sound, or opening to nature, or listening to another person in relational practice, or simply talking to a loved one or talking to a stranger, when you let go of all the things we add to that moment and we're simply connecting, we're practicing this link of disenchantment. We're practicing clearing ourselves from our enchantments, of our projections. Projection is a nice, simple way of speaking of what we bring to the moment, what we paint upon the moment. We project our history, project our longings, our fears upon this moment. And with ignorance driving this projection, our world is naturally created and naturally drives us toward craving, toward wanting or not wanting. It's like it's almost inevitable, unless we really bring a lot of attention to bear upon that process. We're inclined very easily toward that. And so meditation, and it's allowing the moment to be just how it is, starting to see through our projections, we're actually starting to relate to the actual world, not our ideas or projections of the world. We're starting to open to the world how it is. And this is a very different way of being. This is how I often like to start the meditation, as I did this evening. It's beginning by just acknowledging what is here right now. What is this body like? What is this mind like? This heart like? And by that simple acknowledgement, we start to allow it to be just how it is. And if we don't acknowledge it, we tend to easily get lost in that fighting, that friction with it. Another way to say it, we're lost in this spell. And so when we allow things, we start to allow things to be as they are, we start to see things how they actually are. And then naturally we start to move toward disenchantment, dispassion, moving along these links of transcendental dependent origination. We're starting to disengage from our normal clinging, our normal craving. So how can we release from this enchantment, Now, again, this is embedded in our practice. So I'm trying to make this point, this simple point, that how we practice, if we incline it, that, oh, letting go of thought, coming back to the directness of my experience, is actually profoundly waking me up from that enchantment. So starting in a very simple, easy, direct way, seeing something like a tree. And then as you see that tree, notice how the idea of tree comes, the sense of what that tree means to you, as I spoke about months ago, and then it was Nama Rupa or consciousness. And start to release that idea, release what we add to the tree, to allow the tree to be just how it is. Let the tree reveal itself to you. And it starts to feel like an actual communication, like you're actually receiving the essence of this other substance, other, I'm going to say other being, but really this tree, this other thing. We start to experience, when we stop fixing the tree in our minds, at labeling it and placing it, we actually free ourselves to experience it how it actually is. Seeing through our projection to the actual thing, letting life in fully. This is starting to become free of our enchantment, a process of disenchantment. And the same practice we use with our breath, with our body, you know, parts of the body which are painful, that are pleasant. Can I start to see them and free my projection around them? Start to allow that thing to be itself. I know, especially with something like chronic pain, when someone is able to do this, to actually turn toward that pain and free themselves from the fear of that pain, the projection of that pain, the history around that pain, the worry about what the future will be around that pain, to actually turn toward it with an innocence, with a curiosity, often that pain starts to transform and change. Same process with our breath, with our thoughts, our emotions. These start to become a little harder because they're so entrenched in us. The body is a nice way to start because our body has its own experience, its own kind of authority. And we add our mind's idea and projection around it. And sometimes it's a very painful projection, you know, of body image and all those qualities of distortion that can sometimes arise. But to learn to actually close your eyes and feel the felt sense of the body instead of our ideas of the body coming into the reality of it, losing that enchantment. And moving into how we are in our worlds, in our actions, our lives, our hobbies, our the things we like to do, the things we don't like to do. Start to notice how there's that added on thing that if I do this, then I'll be happy, I'll be satisfied, and start to see through that, to see how that promise doesn't pay off. Patterns of worry, of fantasy. This is sometimes harder to do with patterns of worry and anxiety because they have such a, I don't know, an urgency to them, such a sense that I need to pay attention to this. If I don't take care of this, things will fall apart. And yet there's a disillusionment that needs to happen even with that, to see through that just as a mind storm that's arising that's not actually inherently substantial. Moving even deeper to that story, the sense of who I am, my whole biography, my whole history, and how my past shapes who I am today. There is a truth to this. There's a momentum of our past history that shapes how we are in this moment. And yet, it's our buying into that, our sense of investment and identification, our enchantment with it, which maintains that story. And this is the story that we tell ourselves, that I am this kind of a person. I'm not good, or I am good. I'm proud of this. I'm ashamed of that. The story, the self-talk that we rehearse again and again. This is a very strong form of this enchantment. And learning to be disenchanted with it. Oh, that's just my mind speaking again. That's my story again. And it starts to be, oh, I don't have to believe that. And that starts to be very freeing when you don't believe in your own story. And it brings this aliveness, this spontaneity to life. As you start to feel yourself freed of that spell, free of that oppression. And even this sense of me, this sense of self, how that basic, very basic fundamental premise that I am separate, I am having this experience, I am speaking, I'm mad, I am happy, I am scared. Projected outward, you are this, you are that. That fundamental quality is also, in fact, perhaps the most profound and fundamental enchantment, the most fundamental spell that we fall under. But what if that was, we could see that just as a spell, just as something that we've projected onto the moment, onto ourselves, that's actually no more true than all these other spells. This is the wonderful thing to realize, that the simple way of practicing from day one trains us into this much deeper release, this deeper insight. Sometimes we don't recognize that's what we're learning right from the beginning. Sometimes it surprises us when it shakes us and suddenly we realize, oh, wow, I wasn't signing up for that, to see the sense of me see as empty. So just as we can free the sight of a tree from our spell, from our projection of what that tree means to us, what the name of it is, and to actually experience the deep reality of it, we can also free what we really are from that same spell, dropping all definition, all assumption, all projection on the essence of what we are. That's all that's needed, is to stop maintaining the enchantment and to wake up from it. To finish with Samuel Green's poem, everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Walking the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I stop at a single seed of hawksbeard balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle where they will. The practice isn't in this moment. Where is it? Right now. Relaxing, releasing the spell. Letting life, letting the essence of what you are reveal itself. Thank you for your attention. And before we open to some dialogue around the Dharma, around this topic, or whatever might be working within your practice, I'd like to just talk about the practice and reflection for this week. So disenchantment. So this week and thereafter, view the contents of your mind as an enchantment. View the contents of your mind as an enchantment. A spell cast upon the movement, a spell cast upon the moment. So you see life through your conditioning and projections. So what does it take to wake up from this spell? So explore the immediate and moment by moment release from this spell. And how does this support ending the fundamental, persistent enchantment of self and others? So I'll put that in the chat there for your use. You can copy that and paste it and make it in a more friendly way. So this week, just everything that mind says, every story you tell yourself, every thought that you have, just play with the idea that maybe this is just an enchantment. No matter how personal it might be, how valid it might seem, just work with this assumption that this is all an enchantment, like I've been cast under a sorcerer or sorceress's spell. Now, this is hard to do because it's you take it as face value. But just to pause, to say, what if this was just a spell? And then the question is how? What does it take to wake up from this spell? Now look for the immediacy of that answer. How in this very moment can I wake up from this spell? It could be as simple as when I was sitting and opened my eyes and letting the immediacy of life wake me up. And then how does this process of moment by moment waking start to support the ending of the fundamental and this persistent enchantment of self and other? All right, so I hope that is a fruitful practice for you. And next week, I'm going to be going on a little, staying in a cabin in Whidbey Island with my family. So taking a break from teaching. So Lyndall Johnson has offered to cover for this night. So she'll offer a shorter talk and lead you in a discussion around this homework. So now we have a chance for any comments or questions you might have. And I gave you permission to unmute yourself. So you could just unmute yourself, or if you want to do the little virtual hand, you're welcome to do that. If you wave your hand, I may not see it because I can only see a few of you at a time. Okay, Iris, go ahead.
Hi there, Tim. Thank you. I feel like I followed the talk and sort of, you know, get the concepts and have experienced that, you know, some of the time. But with regard to the story about your little doggy, uh-huh. So if your dog, and maybe because he's a dog and not a person, this is an irrelevant question. But if he or she had not added anything to the moment of hearing your sound, what would he have done instead?
Yeah, so the question around my example of the dog and, you know, how does that, you know, what would the dog have done instead? So the point of the story was just to show how linked things get and how we act from that. In his case, going to craving, that wanting, you know, very, you know, simple animal way of doing that. So if he had the very first time he heard that sound before he associated with it, it was just a sound. He would turn toward it with curiosity, with attention, and to see what was there. Right. And then he associated it with that. So this is sometimes I make these examples too simple. But if you go back into something more personal, let's say that you have something that triggers you in your life, that you hear a particular word or phrase. And when you hear that, there's a welling of anger that comes up or a fear that arises with that. So that sound and that conditioning have been linked, right? So that creates that quality of suffering. So learning to hear the sound without the rising of that reaction is part of the work that we do as Dharma students. Sometimes that work has to be done therapeutically, you know, in a psychological standpoint or working with trauma, depending on how connected it is. But it, you know, again, it happens in all these very small ways. Just if you look around your room or your house or wherever you might be and you see something, you see something, it's not just seeing it for seeing's sake. There's something that's added fundamentally to that. It's like you can feel your whole history being added into that moment. And so that illustration of my dog is showing how his very immediate level of trying to feed his belly, that linking happens. But it happens in much more refined ways and constantly in our lives. And learning to unhook that gives us that freedom to discern, okay, is this something I need to really attend to and take care of? Or is it something that I'm really holding into my projections? Does that help? Or is that
Yeah, and you know, I guess it was maybe a bit silly of me to like ask about, you know, what the dog would do, but because I'm increasingly aware of you know, making my sense of self every moment, you know, and I see it, and so I know that that's great. I mean, I know that it's good that I see it. It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just crazy. And in those few moments that I see the sort of big, like, head bubble of thinking that's carrying on by itself and has absolutely very little to do with the reality of what I'm doing with my body, like if I'm gardening or something, to see that separation between what's going on in my head and the reality is really just awesome and terrific, and gives me, you know, glimmers of freedom, you know, small glimmers. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. You're very welcome. Yeah, and that's a nice description of how, and it's, that's part of this process of disillusionment or disenchantment, as we start to see our mind states and our senses of self and our, just how we can be lost in thought and while we're doing something else. That seeing that itself is a form of disenchantment, is that stepping back and realizing we're not so lost in it. And it's, yeah, it can be quite overwhelming when you start to see that, how often that comes up, how quickly that comes up. And just a way to maybe work with that is to realize that seeing itself, of the self, is actually being seen by a more subtle self. A more subtle sense of you. And that's the part that's evaluating, saying, oh, I recognize that as self. And so I think it's a step that's almost perhaps necessary or very helpful, is that stepping back. But when we stay in there, it's very frustrating, because no matter what I do, that self keeps coming up, because I'm just stepped back into a more subtle sense of self, which is watching. This is like the meditative witness. Mm-hmm. So there's even that itself can fall away, and that takes us to the unknown. So it's very helpful to be able to see how often that sense of self arises, and by seeing it, you're not lost in it in the same way, and there's even a deeper release of that.
Thank you,
Aris. All right, Leslie.
Thank you, Tim. staying with your image of the tree, I'm wondering, if I were an arborist, I would think I knew all kinds of things about that tree. And I would be interested in what you might have to say about that distinction between, oh, we could call it professional expertise, and enchantment. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's a lovely question. Like going back to that poem, that first line, that everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And that's one of the bummers about becoming a more of an expert in something, that we have a lot more that we know about it. And that, and paradoxically, makes this deeper burden upon the moment. We start to see it through our expert eyes. And sometimes we forget to see it with the innocence of a child. And there's we start to see through our knowledge instead of seeing the reality of what's right there. And sometimes it's like it can be very, I was just reading a book, kind of a book about naturalist training, and how the teacher would say, okay, taking his instructors out and say, we're looking for edible plants. Right, so they're all really tuned on edible plants. You would say, okay, what about this plant? And they say all the names about it and what it can do, and what about this one? And each one of those examples, he pointed toward it because there was like maybe an animal hiding in it, or there's something really unusual about the plant. But they didn't see that part because they saw just, okay, edible plants. So it's a way that we really focus our attention in and excluding everything else. And so that's one of the difficulties that we have when we become an expert in something, that we have that extra thing we layer it on. But if we look at this, it's actually that, again, is almost a in-between step to true mastery. This is often seen like in those wonderful Zen stories where the beginner comes in, there's like the possibilities are endless. There's no constraint. And they start to train and they narrow down what they should do and shouldn't do. And at some point they have a technical mastery, but there's not a true mastery. Okay, that's like the arborist being able to know exactly what's going on with the tree. And then at some point, if they really transcend to a deeper level of mastery, they release that burden of always going through their knowledge and meet the immediacy of this moment and come back into this much more wide opening. So then, you know, in the deeper level of a real expert in a field is that they're able to open to something, whether they're, you know, any field, if someone who's really deepened in their understanding of it, they can open with what is here right now. They want to really meet what's here. And they meet it and they say, okay, they draw upon their knowledge and address it in the right way. But they actually rediscover that love for it that sometimes gets lost by the knowledge. So does that speak to that?
Yes, particularly your phrase, seeing through knowledge rather than seeing through, I don't know, just what's there. That arborist's knowledge, it can be very useful.
Yes.
But if that's all that is ever perceived, then they're missing out.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's important is not to confuse our knowledge for something with the thing itself. It's like you're holding the essence. There's an inherent mystery that's something it's beyond what our mind's going to hold in anything. And we can describe it in a way that's very helpful. It allows us to navigate the world and do wonderful things in the world. And yet we just always have to remember there's also that mystery. And the mystery holds the technical knowledge. It holds the skill. While the skill sometimes forgets the mystery.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Leslie. You know, one thing that we're all experts on is who we are, right? You know, I know who I am, and there's a way that defines us and locks us into that. Once if we forgot who we really were and let that actually reveal itself, that's what I was trying to point to in this homework, is start to let go of this fundamental assumption of who you take yourself to be. Who takes someone else to be, because we're the world's experts in ourselves. You know, no one knows us more thoroughly than ourselves. And that knowledge is both a benefit, but also a prison. All right. So also looks like Michelle has a hand up. And then Kathy.
I'll try to explain this. So in practice for me, like imagining through this, how this typically goes is, here's my intellectual knowledge of an enchantment, and now I'm going to do this practice, and what it looks like is asking myself intellectual questions. And then there's this, well, how do I do this? Mm-hmm. Well, let's just try awareness. Let's see what this feels like. But because I've asked because I'm asking the question and I want so much to answer that question, that's permeating the awareness, and it's mm-hmm. coloring how it's you know, like the awareness piece can be very, very strong, but then inside of that awareness is like, well, where's the watcher? Is the watcher still there? Am I doing all those little pieces that bubble up, either as thoughts or simply as kind of a tone, even or like a wanting? There's a hardness, there's an edge to it that's it just feels like I got to get this kind of feeling. And that happens a lot for me.
Yes.
So,
yeah, I think that's very well articulated, you know, and that's really helpful to see that, how that whole pattern arises. And it's, I mean, that's why I often play with beginning a meditation to say, before you start to meditate, you know, before you load everything up, what the meditator does, to actually see what's actually here. Can I interrupt that pattern? And so when you take on a new, you know, exploration like this, or something that you're interested in, how we start it, as you said very nicely, kind of embeds throughout it, that there's always a perspective of you trying to figure it out. That's a fundamental premise that you've established. So you're trying to kind of, you know, you're trying to undercut it and get rid of it, but you're actually, the premise is kind of following you along unseen, but you're actually seeing that effect. So that in itself is very significant. It's very helpful to be able to see that premise that we bring to it. But then how do we work with that? So let me ask you, Michelle, what is the opposite? You said you start with the intellect. What's for you the opposite of the intellect?
Body awareness.
Okay, so let me ask that question a second time. Forget I asked it for a second.
Okay.
And just come into your body and into your heart, and let the answer come from either your body or your heart, not filtering back through the mind. So what is the opposite, furthest removed from the intellect?
This, I don't know how to put that in words. I feel,
well, that's a good start. That's a good clue that you're on the right track.
I mean, I think of the word freedom, but it's not freedom. Mm-hmm. It's more just like not having stuff.
Ah. So that's a really important thing that you discovered there, that the mind knows exactly how to articulate it, right? It can say it with a da-da-da-da-da. But this other element doesn't quite have words for it. It's like, well, it's kind of like freedom, but it's something, it's like it's the absence of something. Okay, so that is the, what you, where you start the inquiry from, is you let that come up. You notice, you know the pattern very well. And so all you have to do is not do that pattern. And so you say, okay, what is opposite of that pattern? You know, let that, and the clue, the benchmarks, the trail markers, or actually the absence of trail markers. Like, you don't know how to say this. You don't know how to describe it. Because you're going kind of beyond where the mind, where words can take you. And that's really the terrain that the practice will unfold from. And then from that point, okay, where's that freedom? And then you just simply let the freedom lead. So it's going to be a lot of trust, a lot of, because that the intellect has served you tremendously in your life. You know, it's helped you in countless ways. And so it's a leap of faith to try something completely different. But yet you also know that the other way, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. That's very helpful to think about. What's the opposite of insert word there, but yeah. Thanks.
And just to rephrase it, as not to think about what the opposite is, but to know what's opposite. Or look what's opposite.
Look for.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, Kathy.
Dim, you're Michelle has articulated really well what the thing that's on my mind, but I just want to go as a little different slant with it too. I realized for the first time that I'm very factually based. If I think I'm not seeing the facts, that it's worthless. I mean, what use is
I don't know what you were talking about, things of the your knowledge of the heart or the, I mean, I consider myself a pretty heartfelt person, but that's not the same as putting the facts aside. And I, this seems to me right now, this is what I'm hoping you'll maybe shed some light on for me here, is that that's going to be really difficult. I've never, it's a new experience. I just,
yeah.
I feel like it's a completely new thing to try.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the way you just articulated that sense of this is a completely new experience. This is completely different. That's the attitude, the courage that's needed for our practice to really deepen, to really unfold. Because if we're always staying in what's known, we're maintaining that the basic premise of dependent origination, or keeping that whole cycle going. Because we're staying in what is comfortable, what's known. And so that willingness to recognize, oh wow, this is what that is in me, that I'm always very factual in this case, or I'm always going this way. To recognize that and to feel the security of it, this is what I often like to do when I bump up against that. And this is another way of saying this. This is kind of our basic default. This is when push comes to shove, that's what I'm going to rely on, is the facts, right? You know, that's the last thing I'm going to give up, is the facts, because that's in some ways the most precious thing to me, right? You know, we all have those versions of what that might be. And so when we start to feel that and we realize the limitations of that, we realize, wow, there's this whole thing I don't understand. My whole life is oriented around facts, as you articulated. It was like, right in that moment, you know, I think it's very helpful to just turn toward that tendency, that deep premise of factual-based living. And bow to it and say, thank you for how you served me, how you've been of benefit for me. Because it has served you tremendously. Otherwise, you wouldn't have adopted it. It may be something that you adopted as a young child. It may be something that's shaped your whole career and all your relationships. It's something that everything is kind of based upon. So if you just kind of try to throw it out, it's going to dig its heels in and say, no. But that sense of appreciation, then it starts to relax a little bit. It starts to almost allow us to entertain, okay, you're not trying to get rid of me. You're not trying to end me. You're not trying to eliminate me, annihilate me. It's more that acknowledgement. It's really coming into that appreciation and really love of that process, that pattern. And then it starts to open up another possibility. Okay, so what, thank you for how you've served me. And what else is there in here in this life? And say, okay, what is opposite of facts? You know, facts, when I hear that word, what for you, what is the opposite of facts?
Oh, poetry, art. Hmm. airy-fairy stuff, I don't know.
Yeah, so something that's not based on the hardness of facts. And to start to say, okay, what if I surrender to that, or if I start to see that aspect in myself or in life, allowing that to actually lead a little bit. So next time you sit, let's make it really concrete for you. Next time you sit, you have the factual thing, the go-to way you've done things. See if you can step back and say, let's see if I can let art carry this, or poetry carry me into this meditation period. And so every time the factual part of you comes up and says, well, this is what you're supposed to do if this is happening, let this other element start to have expression. This is starting to really loosen some of the fundamental roots that your sense of self is based on. And you know, be willing to trust the unknown, to trust, you know, to go beyond that comfort zone. I think you might be surprised by what lies on the other side of it. Is okay. It an is a thank opening? You. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Kathy. All right, anyone else have anything they'd like to share or explore?
I would.
Yes.
Hi. Is this Anthony? Okay.
Yes, Anthony. Sorry, I had to scan through the pictures to find who's unmuted. Good to talk to you again, Anthony.
I don't see where there's a hand to raise sort of digitally, but that's okay. Here I am. So in my meditation practice lately, things have been not so great. And I sit for maybe 45 minutes or an hour each day in the morning. And so I'll sit down and I'm just try maybe to focus on the breath, some really simple stuff. And I'm looking outside, you know, at whatever, or I'm closing my eyes. And I guess my intention is to kind of let go of everything through the breath, to be peaceful, to all that kind of stuff you were talking about. But what keeps happening is there's this pull inside of me, this emotion, this longing, this sense of really deep sadness. And it keeps, like, it seems wrong that I'm trying to breathe and lose that focus. And so my question really is, you know, I know there's a thing called objective meditation, and I just simply, you know, should I be following that down into the depths, you know, that sadness, that pull that says, stop doing what you're doing. This is really important. Focus on this. Or, you know, should I just be trying to kind of go, oh, okay, you're existing, and just breathe and try to feel that sense of peace and letting go? Does that seem like, maybe that's a very simplistic question, but that's what I'm struggling with.
I don't think it's simplistic. Let me see if I understand those two choices again. So you talk about that when you, if I heard you right, that sense of just releasing into the moment, there's a sense of sadness, a deep grief that arises.
Yeah, it's like inside of me, and I'm trying to meditate and trying to just kind of let go of things and feel lighter and follow my breath and to not follow my thoughts. And yet there's this pull inside of me that just keeps saying, come back here, come back here. You know, does that make sense?
So the pull inside you is pulling back to the thoughts that you're trying to let go of?
Yeah, or to just some deep sense of emotion or sadness or something. And it's just pulling me, like, it's like a vortex, you know, it's like this vortex there. And I don't, it's like I'm, I guess, forcing against it or something. Maybe this is getting too deep or something, but it's like, should I be focusing on that and going deeper into that? Or should I be focusing on breathing and trying to just, I don't know. It's like, I don't know if it's the thoughts that are trying to pull me in. I really don't know. I know I have to say about it.
It's a good question. I appreciate you asking it. There's nothing to, just trying to find, you know, to really understand where the question's coming from. So it's a lot of it, the big question is the capacity. So what I mean by that is sometimes we need to really develop that steadiness of mind, that stability, that calmness to be able to see, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we go into something that's painful, we lose that stability. Our minds get really almost brittle, like there's this reactivity that becomes all consuming. And that's a time when it's helpful to say, okay, I'm going to turn away from this intentionally to develop that sense of stillness and calmness, that spaciousness. It's like there's a sutta where the Buddha talks about mindfulness needs to have that pliability, like something that can really meet whatever shape it's hold, you know, like a soft leather bag that can really hold something versus something that's really brittle. So sometimes when we focus on something that's painful, that's charged, that mindfulness gets brittle. But if mindfulness isn't brittle and they're just like, okay, this just feels like this is a bottomless pit, or it just feels like there's a lot of charge to it, but there's at the same time a quality of balance. And so what I mean by balance is that I can feel the sadness or the grief, but I also can feel my body. I can also feel my breath more or less equally. You know, there's that pull, but there's also this other balancing factor. Then it's very helpful to turn toward it, to actually allow yourself to feel that more fully. Because there's going to be these waves of, I'm going to say the word hindrance, but not to diminish it. It's like these contractions in our heart, in our body, that when they arise, they have an intensity. They have a strength to them, at least an initial look at them. And that capacity to just, okay, let me just meet this with spaciousness, with openness, start to unpack those deeper qualities of grief, of pain, can actually show you some deep ways that you're held, and also show you some deep ways of releasing that. The big caveat is to monitor, okay, how am I able to stay this quality of spaciousness? Now, there's times in retreats when I've open to such depth of sadness, you know, just like tears are just flowing out. There's just this deep level of mm-hmm. grief and pain. And yet there's also this thing, okay, I'm definitely feel stable. I feel like my feet are on the ground. I'm aware of my surroundings. Mm. So if I start to lose that awareness of my surroundings, I'm becoming kind of lost in that process. Do you kind of get the sense of that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah.
And so depending on, you know, whatever is unpacking itself and revealing itself, because practice does invite things to unpack and reveal themselves. You just have to see, okay, what's my current capacity? And not to judge it, okay, this is too much to hold right now. Then go back to something that's more centering and calming. But at the same time, you have to be that willingness to go into that discomfort, that intensity is helpful. As long as you stay balanced.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you for all your engaged questions and exploration of this topic.